Hi, everybody. I am Lorraine Bettinger, and I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi,
everybody. Can those in the back hear me okay? If you can't, hold up your hand. I've learned that a microphone's a lot like a spittoon. If you don't have a pretty good sense of distance, it can really be a mess. I want to say thank you to the committee, those responsible for having me here, for the graciousness that I've received ever since I arrived, the lovely room, the corsage, and nice to see all my old friends that I've known over the years. Just have one complaint. Yesterday I ran into this woman out in the lobby and she said, "You look like Helen Brown." And I said, "You don't look so good in black yourself." Before I get started, I would like to introduce to you the man who taught me that joint checking accounts never balance. My husband, John. I'm a member of the ODAT Al-Anon group, the Lunch Bunch Al-Anon group, and the West Side Al-Anon group in Wichita, Kansas. ODAT meets in the morning, Lunch Bunch at noon, and West Side at night, so I can tell you that I attend Al-Anon morning, noon, and night. I'm not a public speaker. I may be more like a cross-eyed javelin thrower. He doesn't set any records, but he sure keeps the audience alert. Al-Anons talk longer than AA's, you know, because we remember more. I've known Cliff Al-Anon for about 8 years. I thought, well, this would be rebuttal time, but then I decided not to have a debate with Cliff. If you were here last night, his team won every prize up and down the coast, and I'm not stupid. I've known Cliff now for about, 3 or 4 years. We had invited Pat to come to Wichita to talk. For some reason, they didn't invite him, which I won't ever understand. So I had not heard him until last night. It was a great pleasure to hear him. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you, Cliff. But Pat and I met in, I believe it was in Albuquerque, before we went to New York the first time, and she's a joy to know. I'd just like to say that I thought John was having fun, too. Our last visit to Nevada, we hit a bull head on. It was between Austin and Fallon. We'd seen the sign, open range. We thought that was some kind of a cook stove. Well, actually, we'd seen those signs and we were watching, but it happened irregardless of that. He just run out there and stopped, so there wasn't anything else to do. Hit him. And John was stone sober. He was driving. But we were not hurt. The car was damaged considerably, however, but we were very fortunate. God was looking after. As I had prayed that he would keep us safe, I forgot to pray for the car. As you can tell, I've regained my sense of humor in Al-Anon. When I first came to Al-Anon, I had totally lost it. I vaguely remember I had one way back there someplace, but through the help of the program, it has returned, and for that I'm very grateful. I enjoyed laughing with Cliff last night about his experiences, and I hope we can laugh together and have a good time this afternoon as we recall some of these tragic things that I can look back on now and laugh, and that makes it better. My eligibility for Al-Anon began 41 years, 2 weeks, and 2 days ago when John and I were married in Dodge City, Kansas. That was a very windy, blustery day, and that might have been an omen because I soon became very verbally windy and he blustered right back. But that day we were so happy. Not a care in the world, it seemed. We thought this was going to be the greatest, or at least I thought this was going to be the greatest marriage ever. And we started out that way. Neither one of us had a job. I had a car, and we had a little bit of money, but we were not worried in the least about that. But before long, I found out that we had one thing in common. We were both married on the same day. But I'm getting ahead of my story. I want to fill you in a little bit on my background, about my family and so forth. I was born in a very small town, population about 100 people. My father didn't drink. In fact, no one in my family, as far as I knew, drank. We did have a town drunk, however. And he apparently was a periodic drinker. I didn't know that then. Didn't even know anything about alcoholism at all. I didn't know the word. But about once a year, he would go on a spree, as they said. And then he would buy all us children candy and pop and ice cream. And the rest of the year, he was very, very tight. So we really liked him better drunk. Our family revolved around family and the church and the school activities. My father was, he owned the bank. He was a trustee of the church. He was on the school board for 30 years. And I was raised, I guess what you'd say, very strictly. My mother put a lot of emphasis on what other people would think of our actions. She'd say, you know, your father's in business and you have to watch what you do. And that probably then fallen into my marriage with an active alcoholic and my trying to deal with that. As I look back on my childhood, I thought of myself as very ugly, that I was dressed very poorly, and that I was very unpopular. Since coming to Al-Anon, I dug out some of my pictures when I was younger, and to my surprise, I looked nicely dressed. I wasn't ugly. Now, whether I was popular or not, I don't know, but nevertheless, my feelings about that were not really what they should have been, and I have no idea why I felt that way. I attended high school, and I had already decided before I got through high school that once I got away from home and got independent and on my own, that I would no longer attend church. I cannot tell you why I made that decision. It was not one of my better decisions, but I was a maverick. I was never happy with the situation as it was. I wanted it to be different or better, unrestricted. I just really was straying against the bitch, you might say, to do things my way and not having any interference from John. When I graduated from high school, my parents decided to send me to Wichita to business college. And I especially liked the idea of getting away from home. But they had me live with my grandmother, so I was going to have to wait a little while for that independence. And they sent me to Mrs. Franklin's Business School for Girls. So that was rather restrictive also. This was during the Depression, 1935. There were no jobs. But through the influence of an uncle who was in business in Wichita, I did get a job as a secretary. Actually, I was a stenographer. Nowadays they call it secretary, then they call it stenographer. And I felt very fortunate to be working. My wages, $10 a week, and they had not heard of the 40-hour week. So you just worked as long as you needed to. And it was when I had been working there a short time that I met John. He was working for his cousin, just the business to the side of where I was working. And he came in one day to see if he could get change for a dollar. He had seen me through the window and wanted to meet me. And he started asking me to go out with him, and I, for a while, I said no, but he won, of course. And that is not the only battle he ever won, but he won that one. And we started dating. We didn't have any money much, but we walked a lot and rode the bus and held hands. And he had just graduated from Northwest University in Oklahoma. He was a college man. And I thought that was just wonderful. Oh, he was so tall and handsome. And I was so madly in love. And he had done some boxing. Now, why that appealed to me today, I cannot tell you. But I just thought that was just extra special that he had been a boxer. Well, he asked me to marry him, and I said yes, but he didn't say when. And it would be 10 years before that happy event took place. I might tell you that one of his favorite places to take me when he did have any money was to the old Heidelberg. And you might guess that that's where they serve beer. Well, part of my plan for independence was to do a little drinking. And so I thought that would just be wonderful to go there with him and have some beer. And I didn't like it. But I drank it anyway because I felt so independent drinking it. But he seemed to like it a lot. The way he liked it the best was one right after the other, right out of the bottle. Well, he lost his job. They ran out of work. And so he went to his home in western Kansas. And then he wrote me a few cards, and he moved to Colorado. And I thought, well, things would work out. After all, we had made an agreement to get married and that we would correspond. I was very despondent about it, very lonely. But I just still was very optimistic, thought it would work out, until I received a letter from him telling me that he had married his high school sweetheart. And I was brokenhearted about that. In about 3.5 years, I married. I was still working the same job that I had taken out of business college. And before long, my new husband and I decided to move to California. Now, this was another one of my dreams of independence, was to go to California. I thought everyone in California was rich, had good jobs. I thought it didn't rain in California. I didn't take my galoshes or raincoat. It didn't rain in California. I don't know where I got that idea either. It rains a lot in California. But our son was born in California, June of 1940. And in December of 1941, Pearl Harbor. And before long, my husband enlisted. He enlisted in March of 1942. And I had to go to work to support my son and myself. I was working, and I was fortunate to get a good job, and I hadn't been on that job but a week, and it was a stenographer. The head bookkeeper of this corporation resigned, and they went through, you had to take these tests in those days, I don't know if you still do or not, and they went through those tests and found out that I had an aptitude as a bookkeeper. And so they came and asked me if I would like to take the job as bookkeeper since the bookkeeper was leaving. Well, I didn't really think so till they told me the salary. And then I thought right away, yeah, I probably could do that. Quite a bit more money. And they were right. I did have an aptitude for bookkeeping. I not only had an aptitude, I liked it. I really liked it. And so I just fell into this wonderful job. Of course, the reason was the shortage of help. You know, they could hardly hire help during the war. So it was very fortunate for me that I got that job and got that experience and that training. They taught me, and I loved it. I had changed jobs and was working in downtown Los Angeles, and I had John's address from an aunt of his laying on my desk. I'd had it there quite a while, and I'd heard that he was divorced. I should explain to you that my husband, after he'd been in the service a very short time, wrote and said that he would like a divorce. He liked his freedom very much, and he liked it better than being married. And he said if I didn't get the divorce, that he would. So I was also divorced. So I thought about writing to John, and then I thought, oh, no. But, you know, it was very patriotic to write to servicemen at that time. In fact, you were not very patriotic if you weren't writing to quite a few servicemen. So one day the mood hit me just right, and I wrote to him. And my goodness, I got an answer right back. He seemed very pleased to hear from me. And we corresponded through the rest of the war. And then when he came back, he called me from San Diego to let me know he was there and asked me to come down. Well, you see, I hadn't seen him in years, probably then almost getting along toward 10 years. So I drove down, and things went very badly. He had been drinking, and I went back to Los Angeles. I was actually living in Glendale, working in Los Angeles, thinking I would never see him again. During our correspondence while he was overseas, and by the way, he was in the Marine Corps stationed in Honolulu and Hilo. So he fought the war from the Pacific Islands. But one strange thing, he was a wonderful correspondent, but then there'd be a period of 4 weeks that I wouldn't hear from him. But then I thought, after all, he's fighting a war, you know, and so I excused that. Well, I didn't know for quite some time after we were married that during those times he was in the brig for his drinking. But if he had told me that, then I wouldn't have believed it anyway. He kidded me a great deal. About a week later, after I had come back from the trip down to San Diego, I had just gotten back into Glendale from Los Angeles at the end of my working day, and the telephone rang, and it was John. And he wanted me to come down he was in Los Angeles, wanted me to come down there. Well, I had just driven in from Los Angeles, and I didn't really want to see him anyway, and so I really wasn't in any mood for that until he told me where he was. He was in the worst part of Los Angeles, and I thought, my word, it's just my patriotic duty to go down and get one of our servicemen out of that terrible place. So I hopped in the car, and now I had it pictured. When I drove up, he would be out on the edge of the sidewalk with his duffel bag waiting for me. Right? Wrong. When I got there, there was no sign of him, and I found him in a bar, and he seemed to know everybody. And he didn't really want to leave. And I sure didn't want to stay there. But I finally talked him into coming out to Glendale. And where I stayed, there were quite a few of us gals that shared the upstairs of this large house. And we had arranged to move in together. I moved in with someone else and let him have my room. And he stayed in California for a week. At that time, my son was 5 years old. And he and John just hit it off wonderfully right from the start and just loved each other. And that had a big influence on my thinking from there on. We decided again to get married. There was just one problem. He insisted on living in Kansas, and I insisted on living in California. So we compromised, and I moved to Kansas. That was not our last compromise. That brings me up to then. I moved to Kansas with my son. John and I were married on April the 2nd, 1946, in Dodge City, Kansas. We visited his relatives for a while, and he was really on his good behavior. He did very little drinking while he was in California after he came up to Los Angeles and Glendale. And from then until we got married, he did very little drinking. He got a job as assistant manager of a drugstore in Kansas City, and we moved to Kansas City. And things were just wonderful. And I was so happy, and our son was so happy, and everything just go along fine. And then he wouldn't show up from work on time. And when he did show up, he'd have been drinking. And, of course, I knew how to handle that. I raved, I screamed, I yelled, and he would say, it'll never happen again. And I would believe him, and things would go along fine for a little while. I remember one night we went to a nightclub, and he got to drinking, and at one point he walked across the room on top of the tables. I was mortified. You see, I thought a really good wife could have kept him down off of those tables. And I thought it was my fault that he did that. When we got back to our room, I told him how awful that was, how embarrassed I was. And he vowed that he would join the Merchant Marine the next morning. And I thought we were still on our honeymoon. But I believed him. I thought he really was going to join the Merchant Marine. But we would patch things up, and he would say, never happen again, and I believed him. One of the worst instances I remember was our son's 6th birthday. I planned a little party, and we were to have it as soon as John got off work. And the time came for him to get there, and we had the gifts and the cake and the ice cream and a very excited little 6-year-old boy, but John didn't show up. Well, of course we couldn't go ahead and have... excuse me. Of course we couldn't go ahead and have that party without him, could we? No way. And then when he did show up and had been drinking, I was furious. How could he ruin this little boy's birthday party? You know, I had been in Al-Anon for years before it dawned on me one day that I ruined that birthday party. He wasn't even there. He became sicker and sicker, and so did I. I went from a happy-go-lucky type of person to a person who wouldn't go out in the yard if my neighbor was in the yard because I was afraid that she would ask me about what had gone on at our house last night. I was afraid when the telephone rang, and I cried hysterically and lost sleep and especially tried to control, and I thought I could. We couldn't find suitable living rooms or house or apartment in Kansas City. It's very difficult after the war to find places to live. So we decided to move to Wichita. And anyway, I wanted to get him away from those terrible people in Kansas City that were causing him to drink like that. We found a place to live in Wichita. And before long, we decided to buy a house, and were able to do that. And people had told me what he needs is responsibility. So I thought the responsibility of a house, a home of his own, you know, that would do it. But actually, things became worse. He would come home drinking, and we would start to fight, and he would pack some things and move out. Then in a few days he would call, and I would go pick him up and bring him home, and he had promised never to do it again, and I believed him, and it just went like a merry-go-round, you know, on and on like this. And whenever he'd promised, you know, not to do it again, I was a born optimist. Until I found out that an optimist is a person who doesn't know what's going on. But I had my suspicions. Reminds me of the story of Eve. You know, she was suspicious of Adam, and one day he didn't come home on time. And she walked the garden, and she'd go to the gate and look for him and walk back and forth and wonder where in the world he was and what was going on. And when he finally showed up, she said, "Who have you been with?" And he said, "Well, Eve, you know that you and I are the only two people on earth." But after he went to sleep, she counted his ribs anyway. Sometimes when John had been drinking was late, he would make the mistake of calling me. And I would scream at him to come right home and not to drink another drop and not to bring any of his friends. But he was like the fellow that was losing his hearing. So he went to the doctor, and the doctor examined him and told him, yes, he was, and that it was caused by his drinking, and if he didn't stop, he would be totally deaf. But he decided he liked what he drank better than what he heard. And that's the way John was. I would tell him to come home, but he liked what he drank better than what he heard. I remember one time a friend of mine invited us to her home for the evening. And so I gave John his instructions before we went. If they served beer, he was to just have one. Well, she had told all of her friends that were going to be there what a clown John was. The clown didn't say a word all evening. And I couldn't understand it and told him so all the way home. I remember at one point I said, "You're driving me crazy." And he said something like, "That's no drive, that's just a short putt." And you know, he was right. I was becoming totally obsessed with his drinking. But I was smarter than our dog. She would go, I had quit going with him. But she would go with him under the worst conditions. But she's been in jail twice. Now I could look at her and think, "There, but for the grace of God, go I." I believe if I had been drowning, his life would have flashed before my eyes. My mental state was much like a story I heard about. This forest ranger came upon the scene of a man being viciously attacked by a grizzly bear. And over at the side stood a woman with a shotgun. And he yelled at her, said, "Why don't you kill him?" And she said, "I thought if I waited a little while, the bear would do it for me." I don't think I would have killed him, but I wouldn't have cared if somebody else had. But he got in trouble on his job, and his boss, the morning before he had to go to work, and he knew he was in a lot of trouble, we were sitting on the edge of the bed, and he said to me, "I must be an alcoholic." You know what I said? "Oh, no, you're not." I knew so much. But I didn't want to be married to an alcoholic. That sounded terrible to me. But he went to work, and his boss, bless his heart, asked him if he would like to call Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, he really didn't know much about it either. But because he was in trouble, he said yes. So together they called, and the man they sent out was also had been in the Marine Corps, and they hit it off beautifully. And so John started to attend AA meetings. His sponsor told me that I should attend open AA meetings. And he gave him a copy of the big AA book. And when John went to work on Monday morning, he left the big AA book laying there on the table. And before I did anything else, I sat down and I read that book from cover to cover. And during that time, I think Cliff said last night, he had a moment of clarity. That's what happened to me. I had a moment of clarity and I knew what was wrong. That I always cry when I tell this, that I needed the higher power in my life and I was willing. And from that time on until this very day, I have accepted and tried to lead my life with the guidance of this higher power, who I choose to call God. Now, this was in the dark ages of 1949, and Al-Anon had not didn't start until 1951. But I attended open AA meetings with John. And we attended all the things around Robbins they were having then and the different things. And life was beautiful. At the time that I had my spiritual awakening, I think John had also must have, because we started attending church together. And we became active in the church, became members. And our son also. And he got into Scouts when he became Cub Scout and then Boy Scout. And the years were good. Now, along about in 1954, we'll say, Al-Anon was started in Wichita. And they invited me, and they were some of them very excited about this. I wasn't excited at all. I wasn't interested. They would invite me. There's only one meeting, of course, a week. They would invite me to go, and I would be too busy. And I was busy. I was working. Our son was active in scouts and things, and we were active in the church. I was very busy. I just was not a joiner. I'd tell my wife not a joiner. I wouldn't go. But finally, I did condescend to go to one Al-Anon meeting. They had an outside speaker. It just happened to be a Catholic priest, and he told us how to keep the alcoholic sober. The only thing is, he didn't tell me anything new. I'd tried all those things. That was back in the days when Al-Anon thought they would invite professionals to come and tell us how to do it. We didn't know any. They didn't know any better, and we needed to be telling him how it was, is the actual truth of the matter. But anyway, I just didn't go back. And it would be 1959 before I started attending Al-Anon. And the way that happened was that John had been working for Boeing for about, well, since his sobriety, which was nearly 10 years. And they sent him on a field trip to California, and he had a slip during that time. This really shook me because I had not thought about him ever drinking again. I just thought, you know, you got into AA and you just stayed sober the rest of your life. So it really shook me up. And then I remembered that they said that Al-Anon was starting a second meeting over on the West Side. The West Side Al-Anon group was starting. And I was willing then to go. And I didn't really know much about Al-Anon, but I thought maybe it would clear up my complexion. It was really bad. And then the AA group met in the other end of that same building, and John was willing to go back to AA, and I wanted to be darn sure he did. So we went to the meeting together. Now, the Al-Anon meeting was just in a very small room at one end of the building, and we had to move in some chairs. And I never will forget that first meeting. There were two AA wives who I had known through attending the open AA meetings with John. And then there was a woman who had come, brought her two daughters and a hyperactive three-year-old boy. And they passed him around during the meeting whenever they could catch him. The lady that led the meeting had brought a good book of some kind. I don't remember seeing any Al-Anon literature at that meeting or for quite some time. But I thought she seemed like a very intelligent woman and liked her. And it turned out that she was from John's hometown, and he told me later was valedictorian of her high school class, so she was a smart woman. And then these two AA wives, each meeting would tell their husband's drunk-a-log. And all that was boring. And I think, oh, I can't go back to that meeting and listen to that one more time where she kicked him down the stairs, you know. Well, fortunately, before I wore out, she did and quit coming. And I think that's usually what happens. They get bored, too, when that's all they come for, you know. But I have not missed a meeting of the West Side Al-Anon group, except when I might have been sick or out of town. And since November of 1949. We moved several times, but finally a man moved to Wichita from Oklahoma City, and he knew about ordering literature from New York, and that helped the group a great deal, and of course we grew. The second meeting that I went to, I want to tell you about this woman. She came, and she had five children at home, and her gas and electricity were shut off, and she didn't know where her husband was, except that he was drinking. And I went to my third meeting to see if she made it through another week. But it was just marvelous what happened to her. She was able to become a nurse through some help through the government, and she raised those five children. Her husband, unfortunately, never did get sobriety, but she was able to get the program and to use it and to get her education. And it's just a marvelous success story how Al-Anon helped her. I learned about the three C's, you know, that I didn't cause it, and I can't cure it, and I can't control it. And I learned that I was no longer alone. I really thought that I had the only problem like this in the whole world, and that it was just terrible, and I was to be pitied, really, to have gotten into such a terrible situation. And of course, I had already accepted God as my higher power, and that helped me a great deal. And I've attended lots of AA meetings, open AA meetings. But some way I never applied that to my life. I was wanting John to do it right, you know, and I helped him every way I could. But being in the Al-Anon program, I was working, and this really helped my career. I was working for this corporation only a short time, And they got in financial difficulty and took Chapter 11 and bankruptcy court, and then they had the court sent out a manager to run the company. The fellow who had been assistant controller of the corporation got worried about his next paycheck, and he quit, so I raced in and applied for this job. Well, back then, they didn't hire women at that level usually in corporations. But because they were bankrupt or practically bankrupt, they decided they better hire me to have someone. Well, I had been doing most of his work anyway, and I really liked it and wanted the job. And so they gave me that job, and I held that job then until the company went out of business 14 years later. But I can tell you that without Al-Anon, I would have never had the courage to go in and ask for that job, or probably the courage to have carried out my responsibilities after I got the job. But I really loved it. I have had many opportunities to put into practice the things that I've learned in Al-Anon. I don't know about you, but I've found it very difficult sometimes to take a trip with an alcoholic, sober or drunk. But several years ago, John and I decided to take the train to California. And I thought, well, this would give me a good opportunity to rest. Our son had moved to California. We were going out to visit him. I'd been working very hard and long hours, and I thought he could rest all the way out there. The only thing is that John likes to get off every time the train stops, while I would just soon sit in the train and look out the window. But I would get off with him to be sure he got back on in time. Never seemed to be too concerned about that. Well, I got to thinking about that before time for us to come back home on the train, so I bought a bunch of magazines and a book, and I started to read. I enjoy reading anyway and just forgot about him. Well, we had stopped at a little station out in the desert, and the train, John was gone from his seat, and the train started up and then stopped and then started on. And a little while, John came back to his seat, and he said, "Did you notice the train stopped back there again?" And I said, "Yes, what was that all about?" And he said, "Well, they stopped for me." He had gotten interested in something and forgot about the train, and they started off without him, and he started running to catch it. He had on his house slippers, or he thought he might have made it. But there was a guy greasing the train and knew how to signal them to stop for him. The only thing that surprised me was they didn't back up for him. I've had Al-Anon ask me, "How do you stop the alcoholic from driving when he's been drinking?" Well, I don't know how to stop the alcoholic from driving when he's been drinking. I hid the keys one time, and I couldn't believe what happened. He bought another car. I guess you just have to let go and let God of that, too. You've laughed so well, I'll tell you another story. I used to have this terrible nightmare, and in this nightmare, John and I would be in a huge city and a strange place, and I would lose him. And I had this nightmare over and over. And several years ago, John and I flew to Copenhagen, Denmark, and then we flew down to Venice. And there we got on a ship, and we took a cruise, 17-day cruise on the Mediterranean, and our ultimate goal was to arrive in Jerusalem. Well, we docked at the port of Haifa, and there the buses were waiting for us this one morning to take us to Jerusalem. And our first stop was the Wailing Wall, and that's where I lost him. Now, in that part of the world, there's lots of diarrhea and very few restrooms. And the last I saw of him, he was looking for one. Well, I had a decision to make. This was the highlight of our trip. That day we were to walk the way that Jesus walked to the cross. But we couldn't find John. And so I had to decide whether to stay there and try to get back together with him or go on the tour. I'd been in Al-Anon, remember. I went on the tour. I knew that I would resent it forever if I missed that tour. And resentments would kill me, you know. And it was a long walking tour. And we walked and walked and walked. And everyone in our group seemed a lot more worried about John than I was. And they kept looking back to see if he maybe was coming or catching up with us. And, in fact, they commented on how unconcerned I seemed to be. Of course, I didn't know that I'd been losing him for 17 years. But I guess you know I used a lot of slogans that day. First thing first, easy does it, one day at a time, and how important is it? I think I used them all. Well, when we finally reached the destination of our buses at the other end of the tour, which was by the Damascus Gate, they had announced that that was where the buses were to pick us up, but I had no idea if John had been listening. He usually left small details like that to me. And when we got there, there was no sign of him. Well, everybody was concerned, of course, you know. Here we are in a strange country, and where's John? But I knew we were to go to Bethlehem the next day, and I knew if we didn't see him in Jerusalem that day, we'd find him in Bethlehem the next day. Just about the time they gave, almost had given up and decided we'd just have to go, well, this old cab came rattling and banging up the hill, and the dust just flew, and out came John. His problem had been that he hadn't taken any money with him, and he had to convince them to take him in the cab over there without any money, and they don't like to do that. But I gladly paid the $3. Where can you get that kind of entertainment for $3? Well, I've learned a lot of things in Al-Anon and tried to put them in practice, and one of the main things I've learned is that I cannot change anyone else. And I've changed my mind about a lot of things, and that is one of the main things that has helped me the most, is that I need to take care of me and not how to take care of other people. And how do I practice the program today? Well, I'm attending, as I told you, 3 Al-Anon meetings a week. Started out with one for several years, that was all. If I'm in another 10 years, I may have to add another one. I attend area assemblies and conferences and such as this, and we go to Round Robins, of course. I'm a sponsor. I sponsor newcomers into the program. I work in public information. I'm on the answering service. And I work at our literature center in Wichita one day a week, and I love that. I really get a big bang out of handling the literature and selling it. And I certainly don't intend to graduate. It's not that kind of a program, is it? And I live in what I like to call day-tight compartments, just today. And that's how the future comes, and I'm very glad of that. When I came to Al-Anon, I could just barely say my name. And then I finally gained the courage to share. And I was told not to say no. So I think I was treasurer. That seems to fall right along with what I was doing in my career and something I knew how to do. And I thought that I would like to do that, and I did like to do that. Then they wanted me to be group representative, and I wasn't too sure about that. But finally I agreed. And I had not been to any assemblies. I heard about them before I became GR, but I was not interested. I was busy, wasn't I? And I just didn't care about that. Till I heard one of them that came back from assembly say what a lot of fun they had at assembly. And it had never occurred to me that might be a fun thing to do. And it is. And so when I became GR, I had to go to the assemblies, and I did enjoy it. Then I became a district representative and then finally area treasurer. And I had no idea that God was preparing me to serve as Southwest Regional Trustee. But I was elected in 1978 to serve 3 years. And during those 3 years, I traveled 65,000 miles to be with people like you. It was a lot of hard work, but it was very, very enjoyable. My last trip as trustee is typical of our jet age. Breakfast in New York, dinner in Wichita, luggage in St. Louis. One year, John and I attended the Al-Anon Regional Service Seminar in South Dakota, first time we'd ever been up that way. And I think it was probably my suggestion that on this trip, why didn't we try to use the first tradition, you know, about unity and our common welfare should come first, you know. And that was one of our best trips that we've ever taken. I always look back on that as a really great trip, and we practiced that. And before that, our trips could have been best described in the words of Winston Churchill, "We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills." You know the rest. But the way of life that comes to me from living in the Al-Anon program is a mountaintop experience. And a poem entitled Together says it better than I can. Who walks alone must fight alone, and all his troubles are his own. He gathers strength, who walks with others, adds to his own and that of his brothers. Who walks with me has strength divine. He has his brothers, his own and mine. The future is in God's hands, and I've looked forward to this day ever since I've been asked, and I certainly thank you for the invitation. It may not have helped anyone else but me, but when I'm asked, I do try to do everything I can in the program of Al-Anon. And in closing, I'd like to share a poem. And these words were penned by British author Emma Louise Haskins, and describe the type of faith I need to cope with adversity. I said to the man who stood at the gate, "Give me a light that I may find my way safely into the unknown." And he replied, "Go out into the darkness and put your hand in the hand of God, and that shall be better than a light and safer than a known way." Thank you very much for listening. I love you all.